Can't you see? I'm calling. A guy like you should wear a warning. It's dangerous. I'm flying. There's no escape. I can't wait. I need a hit. Baby, give me it. You're dangerous. I'm loving it.
FM. 103.1 FM.
This week on Viewpoints.
When the news came back that she actually had a tumor, it was still pretty shocking.
How a brain tumor diagnosis hit a family not once, but twice in 2 years. Then,
I think brand Saudi Arabia is trying to change perceptions, is trying to change attitudes, is trying to get us to see the country in a different way. And sport helps it to do that.
Why is Saudi Arabia really nonstop expanding into sports? I'm Marty Peterson.
And I'm Gary Price. These stories in depth this week on your public affairs magazine, Viewpoints.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today? Sounds like you heard about a July 4th sale. It's a great chance to red, white, and do that job you've been putting off. like an oil change with full synthetic motor oil. Right now, you can get 5 quarts of Pennzoil Platinum with an STP Extended Life Oil Filter for just $34.99. Save on oil, wash and wax, and more this weekend at AutoZone.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Restrictions apply.
The Radio Health Journal podcast gives listeners the latest news on what's trending in health, science, technology, and more.
Certainly, we all want to see suicide prevention, and I'm certain that it does work to a degree. It's when I hear that all suicides are preventable that it makes me bristle, because they are not.
Featuring medical experts who break down complex topics in a way that's easy to understand. Radio Health Journal podcast, available wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at radiohealthjournal.org.
There's a popular saying that goes, "We are all made of stardust." Sounds like a cliche, doesn't it? But according to Dr. Alan Townsend, this quote is actually rooted in reality.
It's true that, you know, every element on Earth, everything that builds everything, came from the almost impossible to imagine heat of now very long dead stars. And that's all we got, and that's all we're going to get. And so they're part of every story the world's ever written, every story the world will ever write.
Townsend is a biogeochemist, a scientist who studies the major elements that make up life around us. Stardust is part of his work, but his knowledge of it extends beyond his work. It's also part of his new book, appropriately called This Ordinary Stardust. In it, he details the story of his career within science and his family, as well as the grief he's traveled through. In November 2013, he was living in Colorado with his wife, Diana, and their 4-year-old daughter, Neva. Everything seemed normal, except there was an issue. Neva wasn't growing as quickly as she should have, and was also suffering from multiple headaches each month. Worried that there could be a serious problem, Townsend and his wife decided to take her to a nearby hospital where doctors ordered an MRI.
When Neva had her MRI, you know, we knew something wasn't right. There had been about 3 or 4 months worth of symptoms and some evidence that something wasn't going on. And by that point, we knew a brain tumor was a possibility, but we thought it was a very, very unlikely one still. So I think most of our heads were around, something's happening, but it's something different. So when the news came back that she actually had a tumor, it was still pretty shocking. And you're in a whirlwind all of a sudden, and you're kind of playing catch up, because things happen real fast after that in terms of figuring out what's going on. And then, you know, within a couple of weeks, she was in for a all-day-long surgery and everything that followed.
Moving forward, the couple dove headfirst into finding the best treatment available for their daughter.
My wife and I were both scientists, and so that sometimes thought of that as both a blessing and a curse. I mean, we knew how to dig for evidence and read original study papers, and we did a whole ton of that in trying to figure out what was best for our daughter.
While the brain surgery couldn't remove the whole tumor on his daughter's pituitary gland, most of it was able to be resected, and Diana had to keep a close eye on Neva to make sure nothing else popped up. This included occasional MRIs and hormone injections. For the next 15 months, the pair focused on caring for their daughter. At the same time, Diana slowly began having problems with her motor skills.
We were actually on a trip together, and she was having pain in her right hand and arm, and thought it was just a repetitive motion injury because she spent so much time on the computer. And that led to it progressing and getting a little bit worse. And so she went and saw a neurologist who wasn't sure either, didn't seem terribly worried, but scheduled an MRI for several weeks out. So he didn't seem super stressed about it, but we weren't sure what was happening. And then she had a morning where she had a really unusual event where basically her brain, as she reported it, was telling one hand to grab something, but the other hand was just sort of waving around in the air. And it really freaked her out, understandably. And we got her an MRI that night, and that's when we learned her diagnosis.
The diagnosis was a devastating brain tumor called glioblastoma that's almost always fatal. According to Dr. Amy Heimberger, professor of neurology surgery at Northwestern University, glioblastoma usually strikes during the middle of a person's life.
Glioblastoma is typically a spontaneously arising disease. It is mostly confined to the brain, and no doctor can ever tell any patient how long they have. But typically, median survival is somewhere in the range of about 15 to 21 months. And typically, recurrence is somewhere in that 6 to 12 month time interval between when you take it out, they go through standard of care, and when it comes back.
There are several ways to treat the disease to extend a person's life expectancy, but currently there's no cure. Townsend says that Diana's diagnosis shook up everything, and what was worse was having to explain her diagnosis to Neva, who was still recovering from her own brain tumor.
There was no perfect formula. We had to kind of walk a tightrope between telling her some, but not telling her everything. But before long, we had to tell her that mom had a tumor in her brain too. And obviously that's pretty tough on her, given what she'd already gone through.
Diana had surgery to remove as much of the tumor as possible and also underwent chemo and radiation. But with something like glioblastoma, there wasn't much else that could be done. She passed away on December 31st, 2015. A little over 2 years after Neva's diagnosis. To help cope with his loss, Townsend turned to his blog, State Factors. He transitioned it from a science blog into personal writings about Neva and Diana's diagnoses. Townsend believes that writing helped him work through and process his grief.
When Neva was diagnosed, I really did just go home that late that night and write that first piece. Totally just for me to kind of work through my own feelings about it, and threw it up on the blog without thinking much about it. And had a number of people reach out that it touched them or that it helped them as they were going through their own difficulties. So that kind of started me down the path of doing that a bit through this, both for me, but also for others.
Townsend says that the outpouring of support on his blog has been extraordinary. In the years since, he's written extensively about Diana. He writes about her personality, her strength, and her kindness. He also writes about Neva, who's now a teenager and just turned 15 years old. Through it all, writing about grief has been one constant, and he credits his wife for pushing him to do so.
This book is really first and foremost came from her asking me to write it a few weeks before she died. She just wanted our story to help others. She wanted to, you know, have that be part of the meaning of it and see if writing about it might help other people through their own difficult paths with any of this. Anything related, but I'm also pretty sure she knew it would help me, you know, in my own healing. She didn't say that, but she was pretty smart.
Grief, whether you're the patient or the family member or friend, can look different for everyone. While some days are better than others, it's a marathon, not a sprint. Heimberger says that some of her patients join support groups and lean on other resources during this time.
Many academic centers have patient support groups that they've developed. Sometimes this also involves counseling. Let's say you have a patient that has children, a large family, and different age categories of individuals that are trying to accept this information. Sometimes it's a good idea to get, you know, a psychiatrist involved, especially when it's young children that are needing to understand or cope or deal with these kinds of potential prognosis and the loss of a parent. But usually most centers throughout the United States have some kind of local patient support group that the patient and the family can access. There's also some national ones as well. But most patients like to attend the care group in their vicinity because that's helpful to them to also access local resources.
And even with a framework in place, Townsend says there's no easy way to go through this kind of ordeal. Many days were filled with a range of different emotions.
It's hard. And, you know, the messages often sound cliched, but I learned they're real, right? And so, you know, try to be present. Just take it as day by day as you can.
Another piece of advice that Townsend has is to never leave anything unsaid. Throughout his wife's cancer battle, the pair didn't shy away from the topics that were harder to discuss.
One of the things Diana and I did, if somebody's facing losing a loved one or a partner, is we didn't really leave anything on the table. We talked very openly and about everything, hopes for the future, you name it. And that was pretty hard at times. I think especially for me, she kind of forced that, but it's one of the things I'm most grateful for because I'm not living in kind of mystery of what she thought and the rest. So I would encourage people to do that if they're facing something like this.
We're all made of stardust and will eventually return back to stardust after we pass. It's part of every story that the universe will ever write. You can find more information on Dr. Alan Townsend and Dr. Amy Heimberger at our website, viewpointsradio.org. Follow Viewpoints Radio on Instagram, X, and Facebook. The segment was written by our associate producer, Annabelle Rivera. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Gary Price.
Coming up, Saudi Arabia's all-in gamble on sports. Part one of this story when Viewpoints returns.
Life hack number 7. Get an iPhone 12 on Straight Talk.
Life hack.
Here's how it works. You walk into Walmart, go to the electronics section, ask for iPhone 12 with 5G and a dual camera system, and select the new Silver Unlimited plan. They'll smile because it's a good plan. You get real unlimited data all for just $20 a month for the whole first year. Get it at Walmart or StraightTalk.com. Straight Talk. Less dollars, more sense. Taxes and fees apply. Requires activation of iPhone 12 and a new Silver Unlimited plan or higher end auto pay enrollment. $25 a month service credit applied for up to 12 months if eligibility requirements are met. For network management practices, visit StraightTalk.com.
Summer is the season we all look forward to. And Macy's is kicking it off with summer's greatest hits. A celebration of those spontaneous moments that we'll remember forever. That day at the beach, backyard barbecues, summer weddings, and fireworks. Because no matter what summer has in store, Macy's is here for the ride. For the big days and all the little moments that make up summer's greatest hits. Let's make this a summer to remember. Check out Macy's.com/summerhits today.
The Radio Health Journal podcast gives listeners the latest news on what's trending in health, science, technology, and more.
Why are certain providers and medical doctors not listening to family members who have lived through a disease path for such a long time?
Featuring medical experts who break down complex topics in a way that's easy to understand. Radio Health Journal podcast, available wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at radiohealthjournal.org.
Thanks for calling Discover. This is Diego.
Hi, Diego. It's Jennifer Coolidge. You know, I just want to say your cashback match makes me feel so special. It really inspired me.
That's great. Doubling the cashback you've earned at the end of your first year is what we do.
Well, I'm doubling everything now. Double dating, double dipping, double feature, double header, double whammy. You know, basically double or nothing.
You earn, we match. Discover cashback match. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
The start of the 2024 Paris Olympics is just a few weeks away. Soon, more than 10,000 of the world's best athletes will convene to take their shot at earning a bronze, silver, or the coveted gold medal. Meanwhile, the rest of us will be watching the festivities and rooting for our favorite athletes from home or at a local pub. During the last Olympics in Tokyo in 2020, more than 3 billion viewers tuned in across TV and digital platforms. NBC Universal, which owns the U.S. media rights to broadcast the event through 2032, reported selling $1.2 billion in advertising for the 2020 Tokyo Games. This past April, the company publicized that it had already exceeded this number and was on track to set a new record for ad sales. As big as this number may seem, it's not out of the ordinary. Each year, sports bring in hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue. And recently, a new face is trying to break into this industry. Saudi Arabia has been investing heavily to establish itself as a global sports hub. Over the last few years, the country has nonstop formed new international leagues and teams across golf, soccer, Formula One, cricket, and other sports.
What is happening in Saudi Arabia right now is a project in its initial stages, so it's immature. And so we're not seeing large numbers of events supported by significant infrastructural development, underscored by or underpinned by a coherent tourism strategy, for example. You know, this is ongoing. And this is really important because we do believe that Saudi Arabia will host the FIFA World Cup for men in 2034. There are rumors possibly of a Saudi Arabian 2036 Olympic bid.
That's Simon Chadwick, a professor of sports and geopolitical economies at SCEMA Business School in France. Chadwick says that more niche sports like horse racing and falconry have long been part of Saudi Arabia's culture, but it wasn't until the latter part of the 20th century that soccer, or in Europe what's known as football, really took off. Today, the country has spent billions to acquire some of the biggest names in the sport, like Portuguese sensation Cristiano Ronaldo. Many experts point to Saudi's de facto ruler, Mohammed bin Salman, for this nonstop expansion into sports.
It was very important in changing the emphasis from more traditional pursuits like falconry and equine sports to not only more modern sports. And when I use this word modern again, I think about esports as another example, which obviously is a very kind of late 20th and early 21st century phenomenon. But he has been the principal initiator of this focus on sport and this focus on sports investments.
With this shift, there are many critics who argue that Saudi Arabia is trying to revamp its global image through sports. The country has long been known as a conservative state with hardline traditional values around religion, gender norms, free speech, and what's generally accepted in society. It's also no stranger to past human rights controversies and unfair labor practices.
We know, many of us, that Saudi Arabia has a particular reputation, and that is an outcome of several episodes over the last 20 years. And so I think brand Saudi Arabia is trying to change perceptions, is trying to change attitudes, is trying to get us to see the country in a different way. And sport helps it to do that. And as I say, some people might label this sport washing. Other people would label it as soft power. And soft power is essentially when countries try to persuade us that, you know, they're actually quite like us, and they're not different and they're not threatening, that they are legitimate members of the international community. And so in terms of how I would characterize Saudi Arabia overall, we've got lots of fighting, fast cars and football events, football, soccer events taking place there, which is typically what you would find in the United States, in Britain, in France, in Germany, in Australia and other parts of the world. So that kind of underscores this whole observation about legitimacy and about soft power.
While this may be part of the narrative, there are also a handful of other reasons behind the country's heavy push into sports.
Saudi Arabia is a country that is hugely dependent upon oil revenues to sustain itself, maybe as much as 40% of GDP annually. And so sport is part of a diversification strategy at a time when obviously the world is kicking back against fossil fuel consumption. The Saudi Arabian economy does need to be more resilient and needs to be able to withstand what potentially will be a very important pivot away from fossil fuels across the world.
Another driver is that the country's population is very young. 70% of citizens are under the age of 35 and are tech savvy, spend a lot of time online, and use social media.
One of the things that I think Saudi Arabia is mindful of is the potential for these young people to become disaffected. If you consider that during the Arab Spring, 12, 13, 14 years ago, the average age of an Arab Spring protester was 26 years old. And what the Saudi authorities are very keen to do is to ensure that we don't see any popular uprising, any questioning of the government. And so sport is one of the ways in which the country is addressing that.
There could be a myriad of other reasons why the oil-rich Gulf country is really investing billions and billions of dollars into these leagues. The reality is that we may never really know. But some optimists are hoping that this will lead to larger cultural shifts in the region as the country takes on a more active role on the global competition stage.
For those of us who believe that sport has the power to do good things to change societies, you know, we could say that Saudi Arabia is a very interesting case study about how transformational sport can actually be.
Join us next week in the first half of Viewpoints for part two of this story on Saudi Arabia's expansion into sports. To find out more about our guest, Simon Chadwick, head to viewpointsradio.org. For more behind the scenes and to support our show, follow Viewpoints Radio on Instagram, X, and Facebook. This segment was written by our executive producer, Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Marty Peterson. This segment is brought to you by Capital One. With no fees or minimums and no overdraft fees, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision in the history of decisions. That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One N.A., member FDIC.
Viewpoints returns in just a moment.
Ew, gotta get rid of this old Backstreet Boys t-shirt.
Tell me why.
Because it stinks, boys.
Tell me why.
I've washed it so many times, but the odor won't come out.
Tell me why.
No, you tell me why I can't get rid of this odor.
Have you tried Downy Rinse and Refresh? It doesn't just cover up odors. It helps remove them.
Wow, it worked, guys.
Yeah.
Downy Rinse and Refresh removes more odor in one wash than the leading value detergent in three washes. Find it wherever you buy laundry products.
Summer is the season we all look forward to, and Macy's is kicking it off with summer's greatest hits. A celebration of those spontaneous moments that we'll remember forever. That day at the beach, backyard barbecues, summer weddings, and fireworks. Because no matter what summer has in store, Macy's is here for the ride. For the big days and all the little moments that make up summer's greatest hits. Let's make this a summer to remember. Check out Macy's.com/summerhits today.
This is Viewpoints Explained. I'm Ebony McMorris. Online reviews are supposed to be an honest and unbiased way for people to share their feelings about a product or service. These reviews have always been a helpful tool for consumers who need some more info. But are all of these anecdotes real? Artificial intelligence-generated reviews are now mixing in with real online reviews, and most people can't tell the difference. A study published in Springer US tested 151 people on their ability to recognize the fakes. Researchers fed Yelp reviews into GPT-4, which is the technology that powers ChatGPT. Then they asked the program to create its own reviews using informal language and typos often found in real postings. The result? A panel of human testers couldn't make out the difference between the AI-generated reviews and the real ones. Most participants actually leaned into the AI reviews, believing that these opinions were written by a person. To add an extra layer, researchers also ran the reviews through programs that were built to detect AI. The software was also fooled and passed off the fake reviews as real. These postings carry a tremendous amount of weight and can lead to frustrated consumers if the positive review is an exaggeration or simply untrue. Large online retailers like Amazon are taking steps to confirm the authenticity of reviews, like marking postings made by verified purchasers. However, smaller scale tactics do still sneak through since there's a never-ending list of items and brands. With the prevalence of AI, it's become harder to trust if the review you're reading is really real. Now, it's not so much a question of who's behind the screen, but what. That's Viewpoints Explained for this week. More in a moment.
Welcome to Culture Crash, where we examine what's new and old in entertainment. I'd never intentionally listened to much Charlie XCX music before a few weeks ago. I mean, I knew the highlights. Boom Clap was a huge hit. She was on I Love It, the awesome dance song she made with Icona Pop. And I did love Speed Drive, her contribution to the Barbie soundtrack last year. But she's never been someone I've listened to full albums by or really taken the time to appreciate. And then, this summer, I started seeing the lime green cover for her latest album, Brat, everywhere. When the album finally came out, the outpouring of Charlie XCX appreciation online was reaching a fever pitch, and I wanted to understand it. So I went in for a full album listen, and I fell in love with it. Brat is Charlie XCX's sixth album, but I think for many of us, it's serving as an on-ramp to her entire catalog of interesting, thoughtful pop. As an album, Brat is a ton of fun. It's hyper-pop and dance music that can absolutely turn a bad day around. It's full of auto-tune, club beats, and references to partying all night. But it's also surprisingly honest and vulnerable. On I Might Say Something Stupid and Sympathy is a Knife, Charlie lays bare her insecurities about her level of fame. Should she be more famous? Do people feel bad for her for never reaching Taylor Swift-level heights? On I Think About It All the Time, she explores her feelings as a 31-year-old with no children. These songs are surprising. They use the same production styles and dance elements as the rest of the album, but they use them to convey melancholy and honesty. On the Girl So Confusing version with Lorde, Charlie and Lord even use an electronic dance track to clear the air and reconcile a friendship. It's magical stuff. And then, like any good rave kid, Charlie is able to wipe the angst away and surround those songs with bass-heavy party music. Songs like 360, Rewind, Apple, and Mean Girls will keep dance clubs well-fed for the rest of the year. What it all amounts to is an album unlike anything else I've listened to, and a real contender for the best album of 2024. Charlie XCX's album Brat is available now. I'm Evan Rook.
When your wiper blades do more smearing than clearing during a storm, it's time to replace them. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and get a pair of Bosch Pure Vision wiper blades on sale now. Buy one, get one free. Offer is valid in-store only. Our professional parts people will even install them for free. Get a better view of the road at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
The Radio Health Journal podcast gives listeners the latest news on what's trending in health, science, technology, and more.
Certainly, we all want to see suicide prevention, and I'm certain that it does work to a degree. It's when I hear that all suicides are preventable that it makes me bristle, because they are not.
Featuring medical experts who break down complex topics in a way that's easy to understand. Radio Health Journal podcast, available wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at radiohealthjournal.org.
That's Viewpoints for this week. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more about upcoming shows and find a library of past programs on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and more information about our guests at viewpointsradio.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Viewpoints.
You're listening to Radio Health Journal, the trusted news source for medicine, science, and technology. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
I'm Mayan Vasta Betancourt.
And I'm Greg Johnson. This week, how human traffickers use natural disasters to prey on victims.
We heard of cases of U.S. citizen children who were being trafficked by their parents, to foreign national children who were in forced labor.
But first, why doesn't society have more empathy for the homeless population?
It is very much human nature to see a person and say, you know, here you are in the street, you've made bad decisions.
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
Life hack number 7, get an iPhone 12 on Straight Talk.
Life hack.
Here's how it works. You walk into Walmart, go to the electronics section, ask for iPhone 12 with 5G and a dual camera system, and select the new Silver Unlimited plan. They'll smile because it's a good plan. You get real unlimited data all for just $20 a month for the whole first year. Get it at Walmart or StraightTalk.com. Straight Talk. Less dollars, more sense.
Taxes and fees apply. Requires activation of iPhone 12 and a new Silver Unlimited plan or higher end auto pay enrollment. $25 a month service credit applied for up to 12 months if eligibility requirements are met. For network management practices, visit StraightTalk.com.
Each week on the Viewpoints Radio podcast, you'll hear from our leading experts on an important topic within education, history, society, psychology, and more.
Building AI systems is like having kids. You want your kids to be smarter than you are. You want your kids to be more successful than you are. And at the end of the day, you want your kids not to kill you.
Viewpoints Radio podcast is produced by our team of award-winning journalists. Subscribe today by searching Viewpoints Radio wherever you listen to podcasts.
Homelessness in America is an urgent public health issue. The U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness states that more than half of Americans live paycheck to paycheck, just one crisis away from losing the roof over their heads. But that doesn't mean that they'll all end up on the street. In fact, those living on the street make up only about a third of the homeless nationwide. Far more sleep in shelters or in their cars. And less than 20% are chronically homeless. The rest have fallen over the edge of poverty for just a few days or weeks.
There is no real single predictor of what separates a very, very poor person or family from being housed or homeless. It's just there are no easy predictors of that. It just seems to be some crisis of economic proportions.
That's Dr. Deborah Padgett. professor of social work and global public health at the Silver School of Social Work at New York University.
For any given person, it's often a matter of a life of poverty, sometimes of trauma, and then a medical crisis or an eviction based on landlords upgrading the properties, raising the rents exorbitantly. Those kinds of things happen at the downstream or sort of the proximal level. But the ultimate cause of homelessness is the fact that since the Reagan era, and starting somewhat before that, the federal government has stopped building new public housing and really ratcheted back support for rental vouchers and that kind of thing. And for the most part, left it to the private sector to build housing with some kind of hope or wish that some proportion of that would be affordable, which, of course, for the private sector would cut into profits, so makes it very difficult.
Nearly half of Americans don't have enough savings to pay an unexpected bill of just $400. So the homeless could be anyone.
The typical, if you say average homeless situation is a single parent, usually a mother with young children. And again, you get disproportionate numbers of African-American young mothers and young children. But what we're seeing also with families is a growing crisis of older single adults or older adults with adult children who are homeless, living together with their adult children in cars. And then among youth, the average homeless youth is someone who's either aged out of foster care or is a runaway or a pushaway, shall we say, from a dysfunctional family situation.
Most people are unaware of that, Padgett says, and instead accept as fact many of the myths and misconceptions about the homeless. Sadly, this misinformation often makes the conclusion that if you're homeless, it must be your own fault.
To blame the victim is sort of to shine the spotlight away from the larger picture of what's going on here. But it is very much human nature to see a person and say, you know, here you are on the street, you've made bad decisions, you're using drugs, or you had a health crisis you couldn't work around, or, you know, these kinds of things.
Padgett says one of the biggest myths is that most homeless people are mentally ill, turned out onto the streets by deinstitutionalization. However, Padgett says that the proportion of mentally ill homeless people isn't that big, nor does deinstitutionalization fit into the timeline of when homelessness exploded.
Given the persons who were severely psychotic on the street were so visible and got so much of the public attention, there was this natural tendency to say, well, we closed the hospitals, therefore most homeless people are those patients who were released from hospitals and had nowhere to go. But the problem with that is that deinstitutionalization really started in the 1960s and 70s. So there isn't a timeline that really does that fit.
Another myth, that most homeless people are alcoholics or drug abusers who spend whatever money they get on their habit. Padgett says experts believe that 20 to 40% of the homeless have a substance abuse issue. That's still a serious number, but she says it's rarely the sole cause of homelessness. More often, it's a response to being homeless.
We don't want to pretend that they don't spend money on drugs or alcohol, but so do the rest of us. In our homes, so does the rest of American society spend. And to a large extent, that spending is often a way of kind of escaping the realities and the horrors of living on the street. So that's kind of the approach that we take, is that some people do spend their money. But when we really talk to them about how they make a living and what little money they can make through recycling cans and so forth, most of that goes to buying food or toiletries and necessities.
Homeless people are also often seen as criminals who are prone to violence. Padgett says in reality, violent acts are often in self-defense. What's more, the homeless are more likely to be victims of a crime than perpetrators. However, it's true that homeless people are more likely to have criminal justice intervention, but that's because homelessness itself has been criminalized.
It's been criminalized from the very beginning, but it seems to be getting worse as public sympathy to help the homeless or to punish them tends to rise and fall. But local business districts and usually political authorities see no upside to it and prefer to have the police or some ways to punish the homeless. And so the criminalization is largely small ordinance violations like trespassing, public urination, but whatever they're doing are just doing the things that the rest of us do indoors but don't get punished for. And the criminalization comes from getting a summons to appear in court, you don't appear in court, then a fine goes out, and before you know it, you're in jail for not paying the fine for that small infraction. And so many homeless people get caught up in the system and end up spending some time in jail strictly for doing things that, like I said, the rest of us do indoors and don't get punished.
Many people believe that the whole problem wouldn't exist if the homeless had enough responsibility to go out and get a job. But what you may not know is that many homeless people already do have jobs, but they don't pay enough.
The significant proportion of homeless people do have jobs. These are often people who sleep in their cars because they simply cannot afford to pay the rent on the salary that they're making. The ones we interview, the homeless people, are more likely to be chronically homeless and to have mental problems and so forth. But even those individuals have what we call kind of income-creating activities, whether it's recycling cans, passing out flyers for a local business. Sometimes it's sort of underground economy. It could be selling drugs or contraband type things. But most homeless people have some way to get an income, and a fairly significant percent, particularly outside of big cities, do have jobs. They just can't afford rent.
And if you want to get a job, how can you look like a viable candidate in interviews when you're living in a shelter or on the street?
We've seen people who try to stay clean, and it's hard to take a shower and get cleaned up to go to your job when you're sleeping in a tent, you know, on an overpass. And for those, but it's also fair to say that many cannot get a job. Either they're not competitive due to mental illness or other problems in their lives where they didn't get enough education or job experience to make them competitive. And, you know, in an economy that's become increasingly more technologized and more reliant on more education and more training, these individuals are the first to be left behind when it comes to looking for a job.
If the goal is to get people off the streets, get a job, and get off drugs and alcohol, Padgett says the surprising solution is to provide housing first. Don't require them to abstain from drugs first or have a job first. It's nearly impossible to do all of those things without a home. And those rules simply drive homelessness up.
People just thought, it's not going to work. You're not going to take a person who's actively using crack or drinking heavily, has a mental illness. It's not going to work. They can't live indoors. They can't. Well, it did work. And you can take people that had been ignored by every other homeless program and give them access to housing, and lo and behold, they adjust and they do pretty well. That was kind of the revelation, I think, of Housing First, is that it went against every core tenet that we had in American society, that if you didn't have housing, you had to earn your way back into that situation. And it was a fairly gutsy move to say, no, you need a home first. It's never housing only. It's always housing plus, because individuals often do need help with money management or nutrition or cooking and doing things to adjust to living indoors.
However, Padgett says we lack the political will to take the billions we spend on shelters and jail cells and put it instead into subsidized housing for the poor. It's a culturally difficult adjustment to make.
We do have compassion. We're better at, for example, we have disability income for a person who has a diagnosed serious mental illness. So they make a certain amount a month. If you have a sight problem or if you're physically disabled, we do have programs for those individuals. But what we don't seem to do very well at, and what we seem to have lost compassion about, is just being poor without having a disability and just simply not able to pay the rent.
You can find out more about Dr. Deborah Padgett and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. For more behind the scenes, follow Radio Health Journal on Facebook, Instagram, and X. This segment originally aired November 2019 and was written and produced by Reed Pence. Our lead producer is Kristen Farah. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
Coming up, why do human trafficking cases rise in the wake of a natural disaster? When Radio Health Journal returns.
Summer is the season we all look forward to, and Macy's is kicking it off with summer's greatest hits, a celebration of those spontaneous moments that we'll remember forever. That day at the beach, backyard barbecues, summer weddings, and fireworks. Because no matter what summer has in store, Macy's is here for the ride, for the big days and all the little moments that make up summer's greatest hits. Let's make this a summer to remember. Check out Macy's.com/summerhits today.
have a secret.
Uh-huh.
I use Secret Whole Body Deodorant because more than just my armpits stink.
Oh, can I use it where my bra rubs under my...
Oh, yeah.
And what about down there? You know, my...
Totally. 4 out of 5 gynecologists would recommend it. So I tried it, and now I get 72 hours of freshness from my pits to my...
Ooh, I love that it's a spray.
Me too. And it comes in sticks and creams, too. Go get your Secret Whole Body Deodorant.
The NOAA National Weather Service forecasters are predicting above normal hurricane activity this year, including 4 to 7 major hurricanes. Aside from the obvious destruction this extreme weather brings, another threat looms underneath all of the chaos: human trafficking. Leanne McCallum-Dissell says natural disasters create plenty of vulnerabilities within communities for traffickers to exploit.
So natural disasters create housing instability, they create resource scarcity, folks lose their jobs and livelihoods, and so it's much easier to fall victim to exploitation because you may not have better alternatives. You might take that sketchy job because you no longer have your community where you worked or whatnot.
McCallum is a research analyst and training and technical assistance provider in the Victimization and Response Program at RTI International. She says these vulnerabilities evolve during the aftermath of a natural disaster. The first wave mainly affects those who've been directly impacted by the storm.
So that would be folks who lost their homes, family units that are disconnected, people who are already living in poverty or face discrimination. Disproportionately, people living in poverty are living in communities that are impacted by disasters. So for example, they may be living in floodplains or in places that have higher incidences of disasters because of redlining and because of cost of living. And so those folks that may have fewer resources to support themselves after a disaster are more likely to be taken advantage of by a trafficker.
The second wave of vulnerability comes during the rebuilding phase. There are so many contractors hired to fix different parts of the community that it's tough to track how employees are being treated and if they're being paid.
The folks who are doing construction, who are rebuilding roads, who are repairing different things, those folks who tend to be migrant workers or low-wage workers are the most vulnerable because there are issues with enforcement and there's a lot of money that goes into those contracts. And it's a really complex system of subcontractors and sometimes paying folks on the job site. And so it's really hard to track and really hard to enforce.
Even if a big corporation with strong workplace requirements is handling the rebuild, there's often multiple subcontractors involved down the line. McCallum says that the further removed these third-party workers are, the more challenging it is to enforce the same